Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What sort of help is available to the mentally ill served by public hospitals, and how do the professionals who care for them cope with the limitations of working within a flawed system? My guest today is a clinical psychologist who currently works in private practice in New York City. But before she finished her dissertation, she completed a one-year rotation in the mental health unit of the aging Kings County Hospital in Brooklyn, a job that forced her to fight not only the illnesses that plagued her patients, but the bias among psychiatrists at the facility for drug treatment over talk therapy. Darcy Lockman's new memoir is called Brooklyn Zoo, The Education of a Psychotherapist. Darcy, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Thank you for having me.
Tell us what you knew about this place called G Building before you started working at Kings County and how you ended up doing a residency there in the first place.
Well, I knew that the elevators didn't work. From being there at my initial interview, you had to bang on the doors in order to get the elevator operator to come pick you up. But that was pretty much all I knew. Kings County Hospital is known in New York City as being kind of an underfunded hospital for underserved populations. So I knew that in general, but I had never heard of the G Building, which is the psychiatric complex.
And it's funny because you literally, when you got keys, you had like old-fashioned skeleton keys, if that's an indication to people of how neglected the facility itself was.
Yes, that's how we opened the door. We had these enormous keys that looked like they should be opening dungeons or something like that.
It was a transition for you because during graduate school, you were not typically working with acutely ill patients.
Right. I was working with outpatients only in graduate school, and that was my choice. A lot of people did do placements at hospitals during school. I wanted to learn to do talk therapy, which I knew I wouldn't learn to do at a hospital. So it hadn't been my focus. I had treated very ill patients, but no one so ill that they had to be hospitalized, and there is a big difference between the two.
So I think, Darcy, for people who haven't maybe sought out mental health care in recent years, a lot of people say psychiatrist and psychologist, and they use the words almost interchangeably. They are not the same thing.
They're not the same. No, even my friends still get confused. Psychiatrists are medical doctors. They go to medical school with every other doctor you've ever seen. So they learn gross anatomy and about the human body. After you graduate from medical school, you choose a specialty, and that's when someone decides to become a psychiatrist. As a psychologist, I went into a doctoral program in clinical psychology where you spend your 5 years of school learning about the mind as opposed to the brain, though we do neuropsych as well at this point in time. So it's actually an education that specializes in talk therapy, more or less.
Mm-hmm. And it's not that you would never have a patient who went elsewhere to get a drug as a treatment, but that's not the focus of your work.
That's not at all the focus of my work, though when I have patients who want or need evaluations for medication, I certainly refer them out.
Mm-hmm.
They see me, and they occasionally see the psychiatrist for meds.
But ultimately, what you found, at least at Kings County and in the G Building, was that there was a huge bias against the idea of talk therapy as opposed to psychiatry.
I don't know if I would call it a bias. Hospitals do custodial care. They stabilize people and get them out the door. So there isn't a lot of attention paid to the way an illness develops. People are kind of told that they are sick, and there's not really a distinction made between, say, depression and diabetes. So if you are sick, you take medication. We all know that. And people are not told that things are actually a little bit more complicated, and that the treatment for psychological problems, for problems in living, is going to be a little bit different than the treatment for, say, diabetes.
And working in a hospital for you, one of the things that you were told by a mentor was that you had to sort of erase the broad view that you would take of an entire patient. And in this situation, take a sort of telescopic view of the most critical symptoms at that moment.
Right. And she was absolutely right. This was one of the best supervisors I had. She was a psychologist in the psychiatric emergency room. And when you are dealing with someone on such a short-term basis, and I'm talking a couple days, you are focusing on the stressor that brought them to the hospital as opposed to necessarily the context of the rest of their life. But the other thing she said to me was, we're always planting seeds here. So while that is your focus, you're also planting a seed, ideally, that this is related to the context of their broader life and it will need a different kind of dealing with once they're out.
So, for example, there was a young man who was brought in, and he was, among other things, had tried to commit suicide after having problems with his girlfriend. And you couldn't know for sure whether anything made a difference, but you felt like maybe in that case you were sort of planting that seed.
Yes, we actually did a couple, my supervisor and I together, or I watched her, I should say, do a couple pretty intensive psychotherapy sessions with him and his girlfriend. And she was able to suggest to him that being abandoned by his mother very early in his life was what sort of started this abandonment anxiety in him, which contributed to the suicide attempt after his girlfriend left him. So she was saying, this isn't just about your girlfriend, this is about your life.
So you decided that you might not become a better therapist through your time working in G Building, but it might very well, the experience might very well make you a better psychologist. Talk about the difference there.
Psychologist is much broader. Therapy, you know, long-term talk therapy, which is what I learned to do in graduate school, is one of the many things that psychologists do. It happens to be the thing that I enjoy the most mm-hmm. and what I always thought I would want to do. But there are so many other aspects of it that I knew nothing about. And I think even now as a clinical psychologist who does mostly do long-term work with people, it's really helpful that I know about these other areas. My education, as any graduate school education, mine was limited mm-hmm. and kind of circumspect. So knowing about these other areas was, I feel is really important, as well as being able to identify the subtle symptoms of acute mental illness, which I would not have been able to do before I spent some time at the hospital.
Yeah, you described some really interesting encounters with patients where you had to learn, sort of by experience, that, for example, your patients didn't necessarily always tell you the whole truth about their lives or how they had arrived where they were or about their substance use.
Sure. Yeah, that was something that, you know, the people who I had seen in outpatient clinics came because they wanted help, because they were suffering, whereas people who are hospitalized, it's often not exactly of their own doing. Someone brings them in. A lot of people don't want to be there. So it's working with someone who's not necessarily there of their own volition.
Mm-hmm. The first rotation you did was in a unit that determined criminal defendants' fitness to stand trial. And it turned out almost everybody sent for evaluation was, in fact, unfit. What really upset you was that you realized they were unlikely to probably get the sort of help they needed.
Yes. There were people, the people that I met had had such emotional deprivation and abuse, usually since childhood, from what we could glean from them. And they were now, at very least, in their mid-20s. The damage was so severe often, and they had never, of course, gotten any kind of psychological treatment. And because they were now in the system that tends to shuffle people between mental hospitals, jails, and the streets, there weren't a lot of resources that were probably going to be available to them.
Is there mental health care in most jails?
There is. I can't speak to most, mm-hmm. but I know that there's cursory mental health care. People are offered medication, and there is sometimes therapy. So, yes, there is attention paid to that. I think, I can't remember the exact statistic now, but a very high percentage of inmates have diagnosable psychotic disorders, and that's not even to mention, you know, other problems like depression and anxiety, things that are a little less, I don't know if severe is the right word, but a little less pronounced.
Yeah, I think that if I'm correct, the figure that you quoted in the book was like 25%.
Yeah, that's not right. I think that's what it is.
Mm-hmm. So one thing that was striking to you was the amount of secrets and allegiances that you had to keep track of during this this period. And basically, these mental health professionals are not necessarily above office politics the way the rest of us are not above them.
No, nobody is. Yes, people had complicated relationships, just like everywhere. And it's also a very intense environment, which I think makes those complicated relationships sometimes even more difficult. I know it does.
How stressful is the fact that working in a public health facility, you might recommend an ideal treatment program for someone, but there just aren't the resources to provide that?
There aren't the resources, and there isn't often the will on the, you know, on part of the patients themselves. I think when it is communicated to you that you have a disease and now you have to go talk about it, there's going to be some confusion. And on top of that, people who are very ill have probably not have not had great relationship histories from the earliest times, so they're going to be reluctant to get intimately involved with a therapist anyway. So there are so many obstacles to getting outpatient treatment. It actually is provided there. There aren't enough there aren't enough therapists to go around, but people also don't come for a lot of complicated reasons involving shame, involving the explanation for their quote-unquote disease not being very thorough.
Yeah, and that was an interesting thing for you to deal with as well, because based on your earlier training, when someone didn't show up, you would think to yourself, well, what is that saying about how they feel about their situation? And you were being told in some cases, you've got to get tough with these people or else they're not going to listen to you.
Yes. There was one supervisor who I butted heads with who wanted me to set very strict parameters with a patient. And I just didn't understand to what end those parameters were being set. That's not to say that in every situation those would be a bad idea. They certainly aren't. Sometimes they're completely necessary. In this particular case, I was supposed to tell this patient, you have to give me 24 hours notice if you're going to cancel. There was no or if, there was no anything that followed it, and it just seemed to be beside the point, which is, you're not taking advantage of this opportunity to get better, and you and I should be curious about why. And that would be more my approach with a patient. That would have been my ideal approach with a patient.
Did you feel like psychology was not a good fit in some ways for the place where you were working based on how it was set up?
I didn't feel like it was well utilized. I don't think it was necessarily a bad fit. Mm-hmm. I think that, first of all, there were not a lot of psychologists when I was there available to the units. There were two psychiatrists on every unit. There were three psychologists rotating through all the units. And there were 8 units, I believe. So the hospital made it clear that was not their priority, and that was reflected in the way the units were run.
Yeah. So the next place you worked was in this comprehensive psychiatric emergency program, and you write that you both didn't want to be there and you wouldn't have traded the experience for anything.
It was intense. It smelled bad. People were walking around half naked and dirty. So there was kind of, for me, there's a certain not wanting to see that and not wanting to be in that experience, but I also knew I would learn so much that was probably going to be helpful to me. So that was the kind of dichotomy.
And in that situation, you only had a couple of days to really determine whether someone could sort of be stabilized right away or needed to be placed in longer-term care.
Right. They would be, the unit in that ER that I was working on was 72-hour observation. So if it was someone who you thought could get better quickly, or at least be stabilized quickly, I should say, they would be admitted to that unit. You could change your mind, though. If we found that someone was not stable within that 72 hours, they could be taken upstairs to the inpatient unit where they would stay a little longer, or maybe a lot longer, depending on their situation.
And how much contact were you able to have with their loved ones, with their families, when, in fact, those people existed in their lives?
There was a lot of opportunity for it. And my supervisor, again, I had an excellent supervisor there, and we always called whoever was available to talk to get as much information as we could about the patient. Because in that situation, when someone comes in acutely ill, and usually at Kings County in the psych ER they were psychotic, it was hard to get any sort of life history or good idea of what had gone before. Mm-hmm. So we got a lot of what is called collateral information.
Yeah, and it sounds like very few people were there for the first time.
There were a lot of people who the staff knew because they were back again and again. Because there isn't a lot of outpatient treatment that winds up being delivered, whether it's because of access or reluctance on part of the patient, people do tend to be chronic in those settings.
My guest is Darcy Lockman. She's a clinical psychologist in private practice in New York City and author of the new memoir, Brooklyn Zoo, The Education of a Psychotherapist. If you'd like to join the conversation, we have lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is clinical psychologist Darcy Lockman. Her new book is called Brooklyn Zoo, The Education of a Psychotherapist. If you'd like to join the conversation, the number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Darcy, I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about your career trajectory, because it is not as if you went through college, were a psychology major, and then went and did your master's and your PhD. You worked for years as a journalist first.
I did. My mother is actually a therapist, and I was determined to have nothing to do with psychology, so I didn't take a single psych course as an undergrad. I moved to New York and became a magazine assistant, then a magazine writer, mostly freelance, and I got a little bored with it. I wanted to be focused on one thing. Mm-hmm. As a magazine writer, you're always dipping into different areas. And at the same time, like everyone else in New York City, I had gone into therapy. So, and I was just fascinated by it, by what my therapist knew. I wanted to know what she knew. So I decided to go back to school to study psychology to get a PhD.
And it's interesting, a small thread throughout the book is that your fiancé at the time, now your husband, was doing a residency at the same time and had a really different experience than you did.
He was at a private hospital uptown, Columbia Presbyterian. Aesthetically, the experience was very different in that it was just a much nicer place. The facility was nicer. There was email offered on the units and knitting groups, all of these things that we absolutely did not have. So it was really a contrast in that way. But some of the ways it was similar were also striking, which was, though there was an analytic institute there, so there was more attention paid there to psychotherapy. On the units, it was still largely dismissed, and the medical model really ruled. So it was interesting to see the way that at both hospitals, psychology was kind of similarly given the short shrift.
I thought it was interesting how candid you are here about struggling at times with your disdain is the wrong word, but certain patients, as you mentioned earlier, you know, they smelled bad or they'd soiled themselves or they were just unlikable. Talk about what it takes to learn, to get beyond that, to see them as a whole human being, and even when you don't like being with them, to find a way to empathize with them and help them.
You actually, interestingly, you don't learn to get beyond it, you learn to use it. Because what you learn, one of the things you learn as a psychologist is that your emotional reaction to a patient gives you the most information about them. So it's actually about being very accepting of whatever your reaction is and thinking about what that means.
So, in other words, you recognize that there's something valid in even your sense that this person is not likable, and then you look for why.
People make themselves not likable if they are not likable. You know, I think we all go around with this idea that it is our own biases that give us our feelings about others. And while that is not untrue, there's also more to it than that.
Mm-hmm. And another thing that you learned through your mentor was there were times when things that would seem inappropriate to tell another adult in public out in the world outside of the mental health system, sometimes these adults needed to be told things like, you know, wipe your mouth after you eat or things like that.
That was one of the basic lessons in the ER was we're not here to be polite. People need to manage in the world. And when they can't take in what they're telling them, such as you need to be dressed when you are in public, then they are not ready to be out in public. And this is a really important measure of something that's going on with them. It's not just that they don't know any better.
How often did patients want or their families want really extensive care for them, and that simply wasn't available through the public health system?
I would say most people's families wanted them, if people had family involvement, which was, I would say, maybe 50% of the time, mm-hmm. they wanted them out. And families, I was working with a lot of immigrant families, so people who have a very different understanding of mental health than sort of a Western view. I was working with a lot of Caribbean immigrants, West Indian. So it was kind of hard to communicate often what was going on because there was just no conception of what mental illness really was except that it's something really bad and shameful.
Mm-hmm. So you're fighting the stigma as much as anything.
The stigma was a really big thing, yes. And I think one of the ways that the hospital tries to address it is by saying, but this is just a disease. So it's like that's kind of the rallying cry to try to eradicate the shame, but it doesn't work. And it also communicates some misunderstandings, some unfortunate distortions of what's really going on with someone when they have psychological problems.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak now with Andy in Arlington. Hi, Andy.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I am an occupational therapist and have been for about 25 years. And when I first graduated from OT school, one of the requirements was a three-month internship in mental health and working predominantly in hospitals in mental health. Nowadays, because of the situation of how little mental health is taken seriously, it seems, there aren't any positions. There aren't any internships available. And I just didn't know if you could comment on the lack of hospitals there seem to be now.
For the mentally ill in particular?
Exactly.
I know that psychology positions have been cut because of budget cuts. I can't really speak to there being fewer psychiatric units at hospitals. It's just not something I know a lot about.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next on the phone to Aram calling from Grapevine. Hi, Aram.
Hi. I'm wondering why your guest chose the title Zoo for her book. I kind of find it offensive given the fact that she's working on mental health ailments. So if she could elaborate, that would be interesting. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
You know, that was a big concern of both my editor and I for the title. It actually, though, comes from a song, from an Old Dirty Bastard song. Old Dirty Bastard was in the Wu-Tang Clan. He's now deceased. But he wrote a song called Brooklyn Zoo in which he talks about being a patient in the G building. So that's actually where the title comes from.
And the sense is not so much that it's a zoo because of the people you're treating, but
not
because of the chaos of the whole situation.
Exactly, mm-hmm. Yes.
Did you see a lot of empathy among other healthcare professionals there for the patients themselves? I mean, did everyone take the needs and the humanity of these people as seriously as you did, in your opinion?
Absolutely, absolutely. I think it's really hard to be in that environment for as long as a lot of people there were, but I think there's always a lot of sadness for the people there and their opportunities and their chances of recovery or of living rich, meaningful lives. In fact, that sadness can be really overwhelming, and I think one of the ways people deal with it is over time, you have to distance yourself a little. I imagine it's like, if you're, I can't imagine being a pediatric oncologist.
Mm-hmm.
I can imagine just sobbing every day, and you can't. You can't function that way. So there has to be some numbing yourself to people's experience, but not a complete. I think it's a really hard balance for people who work there for a long time. I admire those people. I was only there for a year.
How did you deal with the moments when your emotions really sort of overwhelmed you?
It's difficult in that environment. In your office, when you're seeing people who aren't in crisis, you have more time to think about your reactions after a session and to wonder about what they mean.
Mm-hmm.
In that situation, you don't always have that time, and I think there is some kind of acting out that goes on amongst the staff. Like I write about the recreation therapist who simply doesn't allow the room to be used and doesn't actually offer any recreation groups to the patients. And I think that's one example of being really affected by the patients and shutting down and not really taking the time to think about it. And in some ways, the environment doesn't support giving a lot of thought to those things because it is so chaotic and it is so fast-paced and there's always something more immediate to be dealt with. But the role of a psychologist on an inpatient unit is, for one, to help the staff deal with those outsized emotional reactions.
It's got to be hard when you have become very involved in the plight of a patient and the care of a patient, and then they may sort of disappear from your unit and you don't know whatever happened to them.
That happens in the hospital all the time. You see people for very brief periods. There can be this very intense involvement that's very short-lived. I had the experience of feeling with patients that I had known for 2 or 3 days, like I'd lived out the course of their illness with them over many months. It was really striking, I think because of the intensity of their need and the intensity of the experience. But people disappear, you don't know. And in a way, that's a kind of a microcosm of what practice is like too, or even what relationships are like. People come in and out of your life.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak next with David in Irving. Hi, David.
Hey, Chris. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
Good. I have a question for your guest.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, recently, my girlfriend, we've been dating about 6 months. My girlfriend spent about 5 weeks at a behavioral health clinic as a result of PTSD and severe trauma as a result of a previous relationship. and just curious about friends and family members. Any support for those folks who are going through this process with that person?
There is a National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, which I think is a little different from what you're asking about. What I would always suggest to anyone is seeking out their own psychotherapy, finding a referral through a friend or a doctor or your insurance company for someone who you feel comfortable talking to, how what your partner is struggling with affects you.
We have a question here from Corey via email, and back to the issue of you and your fiancé working in different places, you in a public facility, he in a private hospital. Whether or not that represents, you think, a class divide in how the mental health care system works in this country?
A class divide between my husband and I? Or
well, no, in terms of working in a private hospital and the conditions there as compared with a public hospital, and in other words, whether class really determines the quality of the care you receive? I'm assuming that's her question, by the way. I'm sort of paraphrasing from the email.
Funding determines the quality of the care. You know, interestingly, the Columbia Presbyterian, where my now husband works, is actually in an immigrant-heavy neighborhood in Upper Manhattan. So the community there is really well served by the hospital and feels a real trust in the hospital that I don't think is always there at Kings County.
Mm-hmm.
Kings County is underfunded, and it's funded by the government. Private hospitals get their funding elsewhere. There are more resources available. People who don't live in the neighborhood go to Columbia Presbyterian. No one seeks out Kings County Hospital for treatment when they're ill, either psychologically or physically.
There were a few times when people came into the Comprehensive Psychiatric Evaluation Program, that 72-hour program, and you were almost surprised and taken aback that they sort of looked like people you might see on the street. Talk about why that was so surprising to you compared with the other patients.
I had never seen a first break in schizophrenia, which is the first time someone who is becoming schizophrenic, which is an organic process,
mm-hmm.
happens to, and the people I saw happen to be men in their early 20s generally, which is a common point for a first break for a young man. So they had been fairly high functioning before being hospitalized, and they would come in, you know, kind of stylishly dressed, attractive. These young, like, strapping guys would come in, and it was surprising to me because I hadn't seen it before. I hadn't seen anyone break down for the first time.
What's hard there is, I suppose, and if I'm reading incorrectly from the book, please stop me, but there you don't necessarily know after what appears to be a first break whether fully developed disease will continue,
right,
or whether people will get better.
Right, you don't know. Because it could. There are other, you know, people can be very depressed and become psychotic. There are a lot of different things that could be going on. So you don't know what the course of illness is going to be. Psychological testing, which is expensive and time consuming, wasn't often offered there. Someone with more resources would probably get that at that point. But yes, we didn't know what was going to become of these young men, and you could still see their strengths, and so it was hard to take in that they might be on a really difficult course for a really long time, if one that they maybe never would part from.
In those cases where someone was pretty clearly psychotic, did you think that drugs were definitely appropriate along with talk therapy?
Yeah, for psychosis, absolutely. There are really good antipsychotic medications these days. So for any kind of psychotic illness, I think drugs, this is not my area of expertise, mm-hmm. but I think drugs are probably always appropriate, again, along with the talk therapy. But yes, medication is certainly important for psychotic disorders.
Darcy, in those rare cases where you were able to do more extensive psychological testing, What kind of information were you looking for, and what would you do with the information that you got from those tests?
Psych testing is used diagnostically in a hospital, so we would be able to distinguish between what we would call character disorders and more organic stuff like schizophrenia, using tests that are probably a little bit familiar to people, like the inkblot test, the Rorschach, the intelligence test. There are a bunch of different tests that are administered. There are probably like 6 tests in a standard battery that allow you to make distinctions between symptoms that could indicate anything. You know, if you have a headache, you could have a brain tumor, you could have slept badly the night before, right? And so there are tests that are done. So this is, psychological testing is done in the same spirit, trying to parse out what different symptoms might indicate.
So in the ideal situation, you then take that information and it sort of guides how you direct your therapy.
Absolutely, yes.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Janet in Fort Worth. Hello, Janet.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was wondering if Dr. Lockman could talk. I read the book and I thoroughly enjoyed it. I was wondering if she could talk a little bit about her inspiration to write the book and her decision to write the book before beginning the internship affected her time there, as opposed to someone who wasn't writing a book at the time.
Well, first, I'm so glad you liked it. Thank you for calling. Second, you know, I was taking notes for this book, and I wanted to do it, but I, in a million years, didn't think that I was going to do it. And that may seem like a strange answer, but wanting to write a book and getting a book deal, first of all, are two different things. And having the motivation and the time and the energy to write a book, which I had never done before, is also like, am I going to be able to do this? So the book really felt like a fantasy while I was on the internship. If you would have asked me to place bets on it, I would not have. So it's a great question. And I did, you know, I wrote everything down. And when I was having a hard day, I would think, well, at least this will be good for the book. So it did provide me with some comfort. I also really liked being a journalist and a reporter. So it was kind of fun to have this side project and to think, well, maybe I don't have to leave this part of my life behind, this part of my life that I liked, even though I went into this other field.
And so for people who might be wondering this, you changed identifying information and names where it was appropriate.
Absolutely. The only names that weren't changed in the book are my now husband and one of our classmates, so that I could keep her name the same. But everyone else's name is changed, and the identifying information about the patients is absolutely changed. I didn't even want them to be able to recognize themselves, though I think some of them probably would if they read it.
Do you think they would be bothered by what you wrote about them?
I don't know. It's a good question. I don't think so. I don't think so for the most part. Their friends and family wouldn't be able to identify them, so I don't think anyone would be embarrassed per se. They might, you know, they might like it that they made enough of an impression on someone that they would be, you know, thought interesting enough to appear in a book if they knew. I don't know.
Darcy Lockman is with us. She's a clinical psychologist in private practice in New York City and author of the new memoir, Brooklyn Zoo, The Education of a Psychotherapist. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is clinical psychologist Darcy Lockman. She has a private practice in New York City, and she's author of the new memoir, Brooklyn Zoo, The Education of a Psychotherapist. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Darcy, at times you were dealing with patients who were unstable, who were thought to perhaps be a threat to themselves, potentially to other people. Talk a little bit, if you would, about how fear played into your daily experience when you were at Kings County.
You don't think about it much when you're on the inpatient unit. People are a little bit more stable once they're there. They've been stabilized usually with drugs in the ER.
Mm-hmm.
In the psychiatric emergency room, it's always a little bit more of a... It feels like a little bit more of a present threat because you don't know who's coming in and they haven't been treated yet. Sometimes they haven't gotten even a thorough evaluation yet, and people are a little bit unpredictable. And it's kind of a closer environment in terms of the physical space, at least the building that I was in when I was there. So there is, you do kind of walk around with your back up in a psychiatric emergency room, though for the most part, patients do not hurt anybody.
There was one case where you did feel sort of threatened, and you were not even touched, but there was someone sort of following you really closely who was agitated.
She was very angry at me. She said I had double-crossed her. I had never met her before, but, you know, people are psychotic and people get paranoid and they are afraid. So she kind of hovered over me in a threatening way, and it was scary. I was never a fighter. I'm 5'1". I never learned how to defend myself in that way. So that didn't feel good. And people do occasionally get hit. Everyone who works there long enough gets probably hurt physically at some point.
And you just almost have to be ready for that when it inevitably comes.
Yes, I suppose so. I'm not sure how you're ready for it. I think, you know, for a while I wanted to work in a psych ER when I was there because I was really energized by being there and part of me liked it. And my husband was like, you have to take self-defense if you're going to do that. So maybe that's one way you prepare.
So what's it like, Darcy, to work in this environment all day, to deal with people who are at a place in their lives mentally where maybe it's worse than it's ever been, and then you go out of those locked doors and you're back in the real world? Does it take a while to sort of reset your focus for people who are not in crisis?
It's a good question. When I was starting graduate school, I worked on an inpatient unit. I volunteered. I didn't really do much. I kind of hung around. And I remember leaving at the end of the day and getting on the subway and looking around and just thinking, okay, who here is, you know, everyone here is mentally ill, obviously, because this is the environment I've been in all day. It was mm-hmm. sort of, I carried it with me in that way. I didn't do that at Kings County. It might be because I was actually only in the psych ER in the mornings. Mm-hmm. So I would go back out into the more general hospital where it was a little less intense. By the time I left at the end of the day, it had been 5 hours since I had been in that environment. Maybe that was the difference.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Karen on the line now in Dallas. Hey, Karen.
Hi. I have a question for the doctor. If she has some advice to offer family members that I'm feeling angry and guilty and frustrated, guilty for feeling angry and frustrated with my father, who he has hoarding issues he's a senior, he has hoarding issues, and as his health has declined, he's getting more paranoid about, are people trying to take over his life, and, you know, he's hoarding a lot of stuff in his home, and I'm just not sure. How should family members go about helping someone who's not really clinically mentally ill, but their behaviors are so?
Yeah, I think we've got your question, Karen. It speaks to, Darcy, certainly a person who is mentally ill and has loved ones is never isolated in their struggle.
Is never isolated?
Well, what I mean is that their disease affects more than just them.
Absolutely. There is, as I mentioned before, the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, and they do offer support groups, and it is a nationwide group. It might be something worth Googling. A lot of hospitals will have support groups for family members, and you don't have to have someone in the hospital to go to the group. So that's just one resource. I imagine that there are others. So I would suggest trying to find some sort of support group that helps you better understand your father, as well as cope with your own feelings, you know, the discomfort of the guilt and the anger or whatever the case may be. You know, seeking out your own psychotherapy, I always recommend that as well. But I think these support groups can be enormously helpful.
You wrote very poignantly about one mother of a young man who, I guess he'd been abusing substances. He had some psychosis, and she was afraid that if he didn't get really extensive inpatient care, he wouldn't survive because he was starting fights in this rough neighborhood where he lived. Can you tell us about him?
She was afraid for his life, and rightly so. He was living in a housing project. He was a young man. He was picking fights with certainly the wrong people. He was very provocative. He was really putting himself in dangerous situations. And her first priority, of course, was keeping him alive. And one of the ways she could think to do that was to get him, she wanted him remanded to a court or something so that he would be ordered into rehab because he was in a lot of denial about his problems. So she was, that was a really sad case. She was understandably extremely desperate and scared for her child, who didn't know enough to be so scared and desperate for himself.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Jim is on the line now in Dallas. Hi, Jim.
Yes. Hi, Chris, and thanks for taking my call. I look forward, Doctor, to reading your book.
Thank you.
Two or three questions here. To what degree did you find spirituality or religion more directly playing a role in your long-term therapy? And then could you talk about one event or two when you felt like you really learned something new, not only about the patient, but about yourself? You know, so often we learn more from patients.
The first question, there were a lot of extremely religious patients at the hospital, I am not myself religious. I always try to respect what the patient is bringing to treatment. In those situations, where I saw the religiosity play out was actually in the cancer support group that I did. People were very appreciative of God that they were still alive, things like that. So that was where I mostly worked with that. The people who were acutely ill, while they may have been very religious or spiritual at different points in their lives, that usually wasn't an issue. I listen to whatever patients bring in and want to understand them better in terms of whatever they're talking about, be it religion or, you know, anything else you could name. So I hope that answers your first question. And the second one was what did I learn?
Yeah, the times when you learned as much about yourself from an interaction with a patient as you might have learned about that patient.
Gosh. I saw how the intensity of the situation could really elicit a lot of strong feelings in me, and that if I wasn't careful, they would come out in ways that were more harmful than helpful, which is always the sort of risk you take as a clinician, and learning how to use your feelings for the good of the treatment instead of for the bad, I think is the goal for all of us who practice in a certain way. So I really was able to see sort of the darker stuff that got evoked in me and how I wasn't always good at using it well.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that your mentor said you feel things very strongly for your patients. And it wasn't, in another situation, that might have been a compliment. And in this one, she was concerned.
Yeah, I still puzzle at that. I mean, I'm not sure exactly what she meant. She mm-hmm. was trained in a way that I had a lot of respect for and similar to my training. And my training was always, you aren't critical of yourself for your feelings. You use them. You know, they're your best map to what a treatment should look like and what's going on with the patient. So I was puzzled by that. But I think the most difficult thing that we do as clinicians is learning how to use our feelings to understand our patients better.
One thing that I thought was interesting when you wrote about her, she revealed to you that she had grown up in a sort of chaotic environment. So I guess in some ways, the psych ER for her did not feel so unfamiliar.
That's what she liked to say, and it made so much sense. You know, she kind of wore that as a badge of, I don't know, a badge of honor, but she made no bones about it, and it was just sort of, it reflected how much she had thought about herself and what she was doing there and why would anyone want to be here and how this environment suited her.
So Kings County, the mental health unit, was under a federal investigation for things that happened before that you were there. How much of a shadow did that cast over your time there? And were you sort of looking around from the beginning for signs that things were not good?
I didn't think that things were not good. The New York Post, which is one of the hyperbolic tabloids in New York, would make these assertions that just made the place sound like something out of a gothic movie, and you just thought, well, that can't be true, and it wasn't. It was all exaggerated, but the investigation cast a shadow in that the staff was under constant suspicion. So you're working amongst a group of people in a very difficult environment who are not being supported in a certain way. In mm-hmm. fact, they're being told, you're bad and we're coming to check you out. So it does cast a pall in a way on the work that the staff is able to do. It's hard enough to do that work in an environment that's supportive. And here they are with the Justice Department, you know, coming after them. So it does create this kind of paranoid work environment in a place that's already kind of paranoid.
Yeah. Did the environment at that specific institution make it hard to form the kind of friendships you need in any job to get through the rough days?
You know, most of the staff had been there long enough that they predated the investigation. I think it was hard that year for the staff to maybe put as much into training as they would have otherwise had time to or liked to, because there was this real focus on making sure everything was in order.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Bob in Fort Worth. Hi, Bob.
Hi. Let me just take you off speaker.
All right. Thank you.
Can you hear me?
Yes. Speak up, please.
Okay. I just really a matter of more of a curiosity than anything else for the doctor. When she makes the distinction, and all medical professionals do, about an organic illness such as schizophrenia and other types of mental illnesses like depression or some types of depression, has it ever occurred to you that at the end of the day that everything that a human being experiences must have an organic basis? And I realize for the purposes of treating patients that something like schizophrenia is certainly a whole lot different than, say, a depressed person that's not bipolar. But recognizing that it's all ultimately organically based, I think, has some value in the way you view the treatment of patients ultimately. And I'd just like to hear your comment on
that. Bob, before we get an answer, when you say organic, are you talking about, in that case, biochemical? Is that what you're referring to when you say organic?
Well, not necessarily, but yes, certainly something that is caused by chemicals, but all neurons. For, I mean, ultimately, everybody's behavior is controlled by their thought processes. And neurons firing.
Okay, well, I think we've got an. I'm going to cut you off.
Yeah, I get the question, yeah. And it's a great question, and you're absolutely right. Everything is organic, and everything is environmental. I think we make too much artificial distinction between the two. I think as a beginning clinician, you try to make those distinctions because you want to know what you're dealing with, as if they can be made. Although the thought with something like schizophrenia now is that it's, you know, you can be born prone to depression, and if your environment is a certain way, you may never become depressed. Whereas we think if you are born with certain, and again, no one really knows why schizophrenia develops. It's probably a handful of diseases that develops in many different ways, but that is something that we imagine, independent of the environment, is probably going to develop if you are set on that course in terms of your brain chemistry. So it is a bit of an artificial distinction, and one that the field is kind of constantly struggling with.
How long after this experience was over, this year of residency, did it take for you to really realize how it had affected you and what it gave you as a professional?
I'm still seeing what it gives me. I mean, it's 4 years since I've been gone. And in my private practice today, I will still sometimes see something where I say, well, I would have never noticed this if I had not been at Kings County, and it would have been to the detriment of this patient if I hadn't picked up on this. So to this day, I benefit from that experience. I think every psychologist should work in a hospital for a time, and probably for longer than I did, frankly.
Are you still using writing with or without the intention of publication as a way of sort of organizing your ideas and thoughts about your work?
I'm not writing about my patients currently. A couple of them have asked. I think that some people have written so beautifully about long-term relationships with patients. Mm-hmm. It's been portrayed most recently in Treatment so amazingly. I don't feel like I could do that. I want to keep writing, and I want to write about psychology, but I'm not writing about the work that I'm doing right now. I don't want to write another memoir.
Darcy Lockman is a clinical psychologist in private practice in New York City. Her new memoir is called Brooklyn Zoo, The Education of a Psychotherapist. Darcy, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is our senior producer. You can learn more about upcoming shows and download the free daily podcast online at kera.org/think. Comments, questions, and suggestions can be emailed anytime to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.